Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Featured guest on today's show is Azadeh Moveni, talking about her book Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of Isis. We'll hear from Cheryl Misak, chatting about her biography of mathematician and economist Frank Ramsey, called A Sheer Excess of Powers. And Peter Morfitt discusses Knock 'Em Dead, the latest in his Captain Darak series of crime novels set in Nice. But first of all, Azadeh, welcome.
Thank you very much. Very good to be with you.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we've got a biographer on the show, we've got a fiction writer, yourself, you're a non-fiction writer, a memoirist, a journalist. Has it always been words and writing for you? Was that the way it was always going to go career-wise?
Not really. At the very beginning, when I finished uni, I sort of knew broadly that I wanted to work in the Middle East and that I wanted to work with politics, but I didn't know how. I dabbled and did internships in human rights work at the UN. I sort of tried out other spheres, and I found that I really missed the writing element in all of them. And that's why I, in the end, felt that journalism and then books was the right place, because it sort of bring me into that world, writing about it, trying to frame it, change it, but making writing at the very center. But I wasn't really sure. I felt like I had to expose myself to the nitty-gritty of doing it as an international lawyer or in these more sort of rights-focused ways. And then I just realized I would miss being able to produce a voice in a story.
And you've got two volumes of your memoirs, Lipstick Jihad and Honeymoon in Tehran, memoirs of growing up Iranian in America. How did that influence your writing and your journalism? Because that's about finding more about who you are, isn't it? That's about finding more about your voice.
You know, to be honestly, I didn't want to write memoirs at the beginning. I think it was quite American publishing pathway, especially for a young woman, that directed me down writing in that way. I think if I had been British, if I had been 10 years older, if I had been a man, I could have written a travelogue, I would have written straight reportage. So I think it was quite gendered, the way that in publishing it was sort of thought in New York that I could command an audience for my story. And I enjoyed it mightily, and I read a lot of memoir, and I became quite entranced with the best in that genre. But I think I would have and could have and perhaps would have wanted to come at the writing in a different form and a different style. Because when you think about it, and when I look back now, I feel quite silly having written a memoir at 25. What do you have to say at 25? What is interesting about you, and what wisdom do you have? I don't think that it is a natural form for me. I would not wish to write another memoir. And when I read memoirs now, I sort of have a frustration with them, because in the back of my mind, I think, especially if it's a woman, did she really want to write this? How did she arrive at this form?
And you teach journalism now at NYU. Do you find the motivations for people wanting to be journalists, they're the same as they were before?
The young people I teach, very often they're still quite excited about what they think is war reporting, which always gives me a little bit of a pause. I think people should be drawn to places and not just dynamics of violence, but I think in a way that's part of the allure and the excitement of it. I was quite drawn to a place and understanding that place and my family's history of that place. I think young people are quite keen to see themselves in the story, though. There is an increasing role or tendency for that in foreign correspondence. The journalist has become part of the hero of the story, and it wasn't really the case when I started out. But, you know, it's a hopeful sign that young people want to go into journalism at all, given the bleak reality of what's happening to the media. So in that, I think I'm quite grateful that they're still there and excited about it.
Well, as I say, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll hear your first choice of music now. Is music important to you, Azadeh?
It is. I always feel slightly sheepish because I feel it should be more so. I grew up with music as a kind of generational linkage to where we came from in Iran. There's a homecoming for me always in music. I think in music, all those parts of my life or our background or sort of split geographies come together. So it is still sort of spiritual, I suppose.
So what's the story behind this first choice, which is Lil Watan by Mashru Leila.
This is a song that I listened to a lot in the last few years, and especially when I was working on this book. It's a Lebanese band. I particularly like their style of social critique and their music. They really sing to the restiveness and the discontent of their generation of Lebanese who feel that they're very much sort of sealed into a state and a society that is permanently flawed, that gives them no opportunity and dignity. And I listened to it so much while I was writing because that was the framing of my book that I wanted to bring to the fore, was to write about ISIS as this grotesque failed outcome of the Arab Spring and all of the hopes and the desires of young people that led them out into the streets, that led them out to protest and made them so hopeful, which I think are embodied in this song and the Luatan mean to the nation. So I think it's a sort of ballad to the cynicism of the ruling orders of the Middle East.
نروض قصير لا يتحكم بالمصير نحنا من نسيم منطير ومنرتد على التدمير.
That was Lil Watan by Mashru Leila, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Azadeh Moveni. Azadeh is a journalist, writer and academic who's been covering the Middle East for nearly two decades. Lipstick Jihad, her first memoir, was published in 2007, with the follow-up Honeymoon in Tehran coming out 2 years later. Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS, was published last year and was shortlisted for the Bailey Gifford Prize for nonfiction. It tells the true stories of women who chose to leave their homes, families and country to join the Islamic State. The Times described it as essential reading and The Observer called it brilliant and subtle. I enjoyed it very much too. I mean, I'm not sure if enjoy is the right word. You know, it's quite a difficult read, seeing the choices that these young women made and the pain they caused. And I wonder how it felt writing that.
Almost in the same way that ISIS grew out of an extraordinary, particular and almost irreplicable set of circumstances in the Middle East, I wrote it during a similarly difficult time in my own life. I had just gotten divorced and felt that I had lost years of writing, raising my children. And I felt very adrift. I felt very disconnected from the region because I hadn't reported from it in such a long time. So I sort of threw myself into it and felt some of the pain of these women intermingling with my own in some way. It was a very dark time in my life. And so it felt very natural and correct to be spending it following people's dark stories and trying to understand how they could have made such disastrous decisions. But also, it was an old story. I mean, as a Middle Eastern, it was bewildering to me, and I felt I could tell the political story, but it was that dark tug of my own life in that time that made it tolerable to stay in those lives.
Were you looking for something then in them, and did you find it?
I think I was looking for how to explain views and beliefs that are usually not allowed, that are viewed as terroristic or violent. So to try and sort of say that a young person's decision to participate in something that's so horrific, I mean, I think I've sort of lived in approximation of that my whole life as a journalist, trying to explain what is sort of framed as evil or that cannot be said. I felt like they couldn't explain themselves very well and they went down a disastrous path. But I also wanted to show why or how other pathways had been blocked to them.
And on a practical level, how did you find these women?
Do you know, it was just sort of chasing hay in the wind, country to country, just cultivating people, you know, in that old sort of hack way of finding people to trust you and then introduce you to someone else and persuading them and sort of making your case over and over again and trying to present yourself as not some ravenous journalist just out for something sensational. So it was a lot of relying, I would say, on old contacts and going back, benefiting from having been in this game, I think, a long time. And also sort of showing up and not being so alien to the surroundings.
And you're speaking to women, young women, usually from a range of backgrounds. What struck me was intellectually how each one of them justified their decision to up and either go by themselves or to follow somebody to go into this dangerous area, not knowing what lay ahead for them, which is interesting within itself and also interesting when we compare what we're fed in the media about the choices these women make, that they're just sucked into it, that it's thoughtless and brainless.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, I was so keen to take us a couple of years back in each story so we could see this arc in a number of lives and then trace it back. Because to my mind, the moments before were so absent from the media coverage. Who were these women before they became these archetypes, you know, these bloodthirsty jihadi brides? Who were they when they were 17 or 18, when they were just activists or high school dropouts? What was going on in their neighborhood and in their country that would have made something that could only seem grotesque and incomprehensible from the outside, you know, what could make that seem like an empowering or sensible choice? Because women made that choice at such a volume that I think we had to sort of try and investigate.
And in the UK, I suppose, the case of Shamima Begum has dominated how we see these young women. When you're writing for an audience in this country, you must have been aware you were writing up against that.
You know, I mean, that was, I think, one of my biggest motivations at the beginning, because I was so horrified by the way those girls from London were written about. They were written about as though they were perpetrators of their own exploitation. These were girls that were being groomed, and really it was human trafficking. And, you know, how could we not discern in their context all these dynamics that we saw so readily in others? So I was very much aware of that, very motivated by it. And hope that it would be possible to find them specifically, because I felt that they had captivated the imagination, you know, so thoroughly that if I could follow them and have a different story about them, it might make a difference.
Was there one or more common elements that each of these women had? And they came from a wide variety of backgrounds.
The ones who came from the Middle East, they certainly had one specific common theme, and that was that they were, as women and as citizens of their various countries, very much excluded from politics, sometimes from public life, highly disempowered. So that theme of exclusion to me was very clear. And I think that's particular to the political moment of the Middle East in the wake of the Arab Spring. The other women who came from all over, the Europeans, the Americans, I see some commonalities, but I hesitate to draw too much from them. Because in the end, although we're sort of gripped by it, the numbers are terribly small. So while there were absent fathers and vulnerability, to my mind, it's not quantifiable in the same way.
One thing that did emerge a lot in the backgrounds and the growing up stories of these women was the importance they placed on clothing, what that came to symbolize for them, the veil, the niqab, the hijab.
So many of them were growing up in countries or going through their teenage years in countries that were going through quite tumultuous politics, that were having big fights about the nature of governance or the relationship between citizen and the state, that were fought out in a lot of ways when it came to question of religion in public life and the degree to which freedom of religion should be tolerated. And I was so surprised when I realized that in Tunisia, when I was reporting there, so much of the battle was the opposite of the Western battle. All these religious women who wanted to cover up and who were growing up under a very secular dictatorship that wouldn't allow them to. So it was really just the inverse. I mean, the clothing almost became for women. And I think this is really fascinating because I think we see this across conflict zones and cultures. It becomes a language of rebellion at first, whether it's to cover, to flout a certain set of rules or not to cover, to flout them. It can become a layer of protection and then is read and instrumentalized by groups who want it to mean the other thing. It's fascinating to sort of trace it, but in almost every case, it became a political way to signal something.
And are you still in touch with any of these women as a day?
Some of them, I hear about their conditions or their state from afar, from their lawyers or their families. Some I'm not in touch with at all. I've lost track of them. Some, I don't know what happened to them. You know, we were in touch on different phone numbers and then they disappeared. Some don't want to be in touch. So not in a live way, but from afar.
Thank you, Azadeh. Well, let's take a slight sidestep now, though it's still on the issue of biography, and hear from Cheryl Misak. Cheryl's university professor and professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto. Her biography of mathematician and economist Frank Ramsey was published earlier this year, entitled A Sheer Excess of Powers. The Wall Street Journal described it as an enthralling and glorious book. And when I met Cheryl, I asked her to tell me a little about Frank Ramsey himself.
Frank Ramsey was one of the most compelling academics ever to have graced this very compelling academic town. He died in 1930 at the age of 26. In that very, very short span of time, he managed to really change the face of four or five disciplines, depending on how you count.
And where did you first come across him?
Through my work in philosophy. So I'm a philosopher, and Frank Ramsey was the hero of my last philosophy book. And it was pointed out to me, as I of course knew, that no one had written a biography, an intellectual biography of this really quite remarkable young man. And I was persuaded to fill the gap, as it were.
And as you say, he is remarkable. So why is he not more famous, do you think?
Partly because he worked in very technical disciplines. He was a mathematics don. He published 8 pages of mathematics in his life. Literally an aside, he was writing a paper in the philosophy of mathematics, and he stepped aside to prove a lemma, and that 8 pages is Ramsey theory in combinatoric mathematics. And it's very technical, as are the 2 branches of economics that he ignited. So it took the economics world some decades to catch up to his technical ability, and now he's revered in economics as he is in mathematics, as he is in philosophy. And his span was just so huge, so wide, that I think it's just been thought to be impossible, unless you were Frank Ramsey, to cover all the bases.
What effect would he have on the average person in the streets? They might not know the name or the theory, but would they be impacted in some way by the things he discovered?
I think so. So one of the things that he discovered, although he would not have liked what became of it, but he discovered how to measure partial belief. So when we believe something, we tend not to believe it with 100% certainty. When we say, I think it's raining outside, we believe it with, say, 80% certainty or 99% certainty. And Ramsey figured out how to measure that. And then he figured out how to axiomatize it and put it into a theory that let you say what is rational to do given your degree of belief and your preferences. Now, this theory now underpins most of contemporary economics, most of social science theory. Ramsey would have actually hated it because he didn't think that this system was something that you could easily apply to real human problems. He thought it was highly idealized, but economics has become very mathematized now and very rational choice theory oriented. So unfortunately, Ramsey's ideas do impact us all, but in a way that, as I say, he would not have liked.
And he did all this by 26, 27 when he died. You can't help wondering what he would have gone on to achieve had he lived longer.
You cannot help but wonder. He also, interestingly, had a theory in philosophy, a theory. He wrote a footnote in philosophy about how we might evaluate what we call counterfactual conditionals, things that aren't the case but might have been the case. So had Ramsey not have died, he would have done such and such. Some very well-known American philosophers made out of that footnote entire theories of counterfactual conditionals. So it's kind of cool that we can employ an innovation of Ramsey's to say, we can say some things about what he might have done. So for instance, it's pretty clear that he would have been a code breaker at Bletchley Park. Alan Turing came up to King's College where Ramsey was a mathematics don. Ramsey would have been his supervisor. Turing was supervised by Max Newman at St. John's College, and Turing and Newman went on to be the 2 great code breakers in the Second World War. And Ramsey had exactly that creative mathematical mind.
Then why did he die so young? What happened?
It's been a bit of a mystery, but with the help of 2 very, very good medics, we've figured it out. He had jaundice. He was getting yellower and yellower. And then he got very seriously ill, and they rushed him to London to Guy's Hospital and opened him up and found that both his liver and his kidneys were in a frightful mess. One of the medics that was helping me out was here on sabbatical, an American, he's a rower. And as he was rowing, the clock said, don't fall into the river. There's leptospirosis in the river. And he said he almost capsized the boat. He was so shocked to find that out because he had been helping me figure out the cause of death. And he just thought, that's it. It does actually fit the disease progression perfectly, Biles disease. The other medic said, yes, but these bacteria don't last very long in cold water. That would have meant that he was swimming in the Cam at the end of October and that the cam was warm enough at the end of October for these bacteria to survive. And now you can Google weather, Cambridge, October 1929, and it turns out it was headline news. There was a two-week spell of hot weather then. So I think that he died of Viles disease.
I'm writing the biography of somebody who died at 27. Normally, there wouldn't be a lot to write, but as we've discussed, there's so much to write. So where did you start when you were taking on this challenge?
At the beginning. So it is a biography that deals with his life as well as his work. He had a very interesting life. He was part of the Bloomsbury Circle and the Apostles. He seemed to have had no boring friends. not only Keynes and Russell and G.E. Moore, all of the major intellects of the time, but his friends at Trinity included Zhu Zimo, one of the most important Chinese poets and a bridge between East and West, Pat Blackett, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Lionel Penrose, the father of English genetics. The biography goes through his life from beginning to end, but has a lot of life material in it as well.
Yeah, what was your sources of research? Where did you go?
Ramsay, when he died, had two little girls. He was married to actually someone whose name at least would be very familiar everywhere in Cambridge. Her name was Lettice Ramsay, and she was the Ramsay of Ramsay and Muspratt, the photography studio who took most of the pictures of Cambridge boat clubs and the like. And she was also a renowned portrait photographer. Ramsay has grandchildren, and the grandchildren have materials, and they were very, very kind and let me use them and gave me permission to quote from them. There's archival material at King's College, Cambridge. And then I discovered that in 1982, someone tried to write a biography of Ramsay and went around taping his siblings, his students, his friends. And I got my hands on that wonderful cache of materials. And so I had quite a lot of good material to work with.
And you're a professor of philosophy yourself. Is there anything that you've learnt in this study of him that has come back into your own work?
Oh, most definitely. I had to do a huge amount of work to be able to say sensible things about the economics and the mathematics and the expected utility theory. I learned as much as if I had taken a degree course, or maybe two degree courses. But rather than have my own ham-fisted explanations of the highly technical matters, I got the top, top people in the world to write a guest box. And in this guest box, the Ramsay theorist explains Ramsay theory for the mathematician.
And you mentioned Ramsay has grandchildren. What have been the reaction of his family to this book?
Ramsay was part of Bloomsbury, and both Frank Ramsay and his wife Lettice had very open attitudes towards sex and marriage, and so not everything for the family has been entirely comfortable, but they've been absolutely wonderful and I think excited about seeing the grandfather that they, of course, never met, really be brought into public prominence.
Yes, this is your chance to help with that, and you must feel strongly that he's been overlooked.
Yes, it's not that he's been overlooked. If you go to the economics department here, in the philosophy department, in the maths department, you will find all sorts of Ramsay fans. But he has been overlooked in terms of the wider public. For instance, he was the only philosopher Wittgenstein ever thought really worth talking to. And actually, Ramsay influenced Wittgenstein in a very profound ways. Everyone knows about Wittgenstein, but the wider reading public doesn't know about Ramsay in the same way. So I'm hoping that that changes.
And what next for you?
That's an interesting question. I also work on classical American pragmatism, and there isn't a proper biography of the founder of that doctrine, C.S. Peirce. And a lot of people have said, you should write a biography of Peirce. I may undertake that, but Ramsay was a lovely person. He was open, he was warm, he was all for justice in the working class. And Peirce was a bit of a curmudgeon and not the nicest person. And it was especially wonderful writing a biography of someone who you liked throughout. I have to think hard about whether I'm going to write another biography.
Frank Ramsay, A Sheer Excess of Powers by Sharon Misak is published by the Oxford University Press. Listening to that with me is our featured guest today, Azadeh Moaveni, here to talk about her book, Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. Azadeh, Cheryl, they're saying she enjoyed writing about Frank because she liked her subjects. Did you like the women that you met?
A complicated question. I had to pretend to like some of them because, of course, that's the old fairly unethical dance of the journalist and the subject. Some I did genuinely like and felt genuinely wrenched by their experience. And some were so young that I was just kind of wanted to hug them and be glad they were so resilient. They had gone through so much. I realized, you know, they were still 18 or, you know, 19. But some, you know, they were very manipulative. I felt it was very clear that they lacked empathy and perhaps they had grown up in a very brutal society. Perhaps they weren't raised in a way that empathy seemed advisable or safe thing to feel for others. It was really quite a mix.
And the title of the book, Guest House for Young Widows, I mean, you describe it as a state of mind almost as well, but it is a real place as well.
Indeed, these guest houses were real places. And I felt a bit like a detective when I finally gleaned that, because I would hear about them and hear about them. And sometimes they were called various things. And then what they were called over time changed as the purpose of them changed. Initially, they were just hostels where women coming into the caliphate would register and would get set up with their new clothes and would potentially be matched with husbands. And they would go through some religious training. And then over time, when it became clear that women would just have to remarry after their fighter husbands died, they would be sent back to these hostels. And then they just became overcrowded and intentionally really abrasive, difficult, cramped environment so that women would be compelled to accept to marry someone again. So they were very real. And every city that ISIS controlled had many, if it was a big city or just one or two. And women would mention them over and over again. And it became to me just this kind of physical space. And I sort of then started building, I think, kind of the architecture of my story around them almost, because so much of life would start there for these women and then would cycle back there in the darkest, most terrible way.
Just the status of widows within the Islamic State, it's not good, is it?
You can't even really stay a widow. You were given this four-month period where you could grieve, and religiously, by Islamic law, if you had conceived of your last husband, it would become clear through that window of time. And then they were just compelled to marry again and again. And if women didn't want to, they were sometimes imprisoned or they were sent back to these houses if they had children. Some married again and again for safety. But it was really, I think, through this terrible imposition that it became clear very early to women that none of the promises that this group had made were real at all, that this sort of utopian society was just another war dream of men who wanted more territory.
Let's lighten the mood a little bit with your second choice of music, Taylor Swift, and a great track by her, Wildest Dreams.
This, for me, evokes the idealism and the slightly girlish romantic fantasies of many of the young women who were recruited to the Islamic State. I think it's impossible to talk about the allure of the place to them without acknowledging that there was romance in it. Many of them were second generation daughters of immigrants. I think they felt very out of place in the UK or in France or wherever they were. And they had these dreams of this place, this desert, Middle Eastern fantasy where they belonged, where they were respected, and where they would marry a really attractive man who would sweep them off their feet and they would ride off into the sunset. And the video of this Taylor Swift song in particular captured for me very visually what I felt like many of these young women were imagining lay in wait for them. It's the fantasy before the lights go out on it.
He said, let's get out of this town, drive out of the city, away from the crowds. I thought heaven can't help me now.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And my guest on Bookmark today is Azadeh Moveni, talking about her book, Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. Azadeh, before that Taylor Swift track there, you were talking about romance and idealism. I suppose one of the things that did surprise me in the book was the success, in inverted commas, of some of the relationships that the women had with the men that they were forced to marry.
Yes, I was startled by that as well. It was fairly accidental because a lot of these matches were between local, by that I mean Syrian or Iraqi women and foreign fighters, men who had come from different parts of the region, Turkey, Saudi Arabia. So it wasn't sort of classically arranged marriages where one family knew that they matched with another family and that they sort of had the same values and these two young people would probably have, you know, successful lives where they could accommodate each other. A couple of these women, they had none of that. The families brokered the match because they partly had to survive in this new society where these men were very powerful and these men wanted wives. But some of them ended up, you know, there was the young Syrian woman who married the Turkish fighter and she would wait up for him. And she, you know, it was really sort of a love match in the end. And I think it was important to young women like her because I think it was through these men that they understood the war to some extent. Everything that they learned and heard about it was filtered through the propaganda of this militant group. And then the husband came home and had his sort of narrative about why they had to commit these atrocities. And he was protecting her. And if he didn't protect her, you know, the terrible, rapacious soldiers from the other side would come and do the same to her. So it was all sort of bound together in some of the stories. The marriage that the women had, the trust they had for this new man, for a lot of them, you know, they had been expecting to choose their husband. This young woman that I'm mentioning had been at university. So it was partly, I think, serendipity, though, because a lot of the matches were also quite terrible. Or this young woman who, when she had to remarry, her second husband was awful and she couldn't even bring herself to even countenance him. So there was that. And I felt that it was important to acknowledge that.
And you were speaking to these women really towards the end or on the other side of this experience. How did they explain it to themselves? Did they see it as a moment of madness, that they'd been duped? Were they regretful?
Some of them were terribly regretful at how it had all ended up. Many of them, looking back, imagined that they made those decisions because they were either coerced or their country had gone down that path and they had little choice, or that it seemed like the right thing to hope for a kind of society that had been promised. I think the Syrian ones and the Iraqi ones, women that I've spoken to, were the least remorseful because I think they just saw what happened as part of their country's civil war. And they saw all sides as very vicious and very brutal. Some of the women from the West, I think, were very regretful because they sort of followed the Taylor Swift dream and realized it was utterly stupid and that they had screwed themselves for life. But, you know, many of them also didn't have great families to go back to. They had just been searching for something and had to cope with it.
And then you met the woman called Hajar, who was something else, wasn't she? And tell us about her.
She was extraordinary. She was the only woman I had met. And I met her in a detention camp when the capital at Raqqa fell in after 2017. And she hadn't even fled. She had been captured by Kurdish soldiers and detained. So she wasn't even one of the ones who was fleeing. And she was just a hardcore believer. She was from a Syrian family who she had grown up in a city that had a long history of violence, a city called Hama, where the father of Bashar Assad, Hafez al-Assad, basically raised the city in the 80s, you know, killed thousands of people in a day because there had been an uprising there against his rule. And that sort of was a trauma that kind of worked its way down her family. And she, though, was one of the women who wouldn't even look at me. I could tell that even talking to me, she felt that I in her ideological view, I guess, a non-human. She thought that the whole apocalyptic prophecy of ISIS was going to come true, that the streets and the cities of Syria would fill with blood and it would be end of times. But she was also deeply traumatized. So she bought the whole sort of mythology of it. But then as we spoke, you know, talking about her family and what had happened and how her city had become a sort of graveyard in the 80s, it was so hard to sort of untangle the kind of cold, totally sort of dehumanizing attitude she had about the immediate situation around her from this kind of intergenerational trauma that she had lived through and that her family had lived through. Her father had gone missing. So in a way, she was that kind of true believer I had been looking for. But then her story just, I felt, took me back to the cycles of violence that explained all of this. So I sort of thought she would unlock something for me, but instead she just took me back to the starting point.
Thank you, Azadeh. We'll come back to you in just a moment, but let's step from Syria to Nice. Knock 'Em Dead is the fourth in Peter Morfitt's Captain Derrick series of crime novels set in Nice. Award-winning crime writer Jim Kelly and a former guest on Bookmark said of it, "Pin-sharp crime scenes and devilish detail, Knock 'Em Dead is a winner from page one." When I talked to Peter, I asked him, first of all, to tell me what Knock 'Em Dead is about.
As the curtain goes up on the story, life can rarely have seemed more full of promise for Derrick. The police team he leads is flourishing. The jazz group in which he plays is going from strength to strength. And more personally, the prospect of securing a future together with the woman he loves, fellow officer Frankie Lejeune, that seems closer than ever. So things start well, but almost immediately he receives a double blow and the picture changes dramatically. The first of those blows is that his long-standing and invaluable first lieutenant, Lieutenant Grano, fails his biennial police medical. And then in a more surprising development, Frankie's feelings for Derrick appear to have cooled. And what seemed very close to him suddenly seems very far away. So Derrick has a lot on his mind when he and the team are called to the suspicious death of an elderly man at nearby Saint-Laurent-de-Var rail station. And a combined operation there identifies the victim as the comedy actor Amboise Pio. And as Derrick's newfound problems continue, the Saint-Laurent case, because of the celebrity of the victim, becomes international news. And Derrick and his team have to draw on every resource at their disposal to get to the bottom of this case.
The character of Amboise Pio, where did he come from?
Well, although he's French through and through and his story is shaped by French mores and French culture, he owes his genesis, at least in part, to my own childhood experience. And this is where a rather glamorous lady called Violet Hamilton comes into the picture, somebody I knew better as my Auntie Vi. She was on the variety stage from an early age, but made quite a mark off it later when she became a very sought-after wardrobe mistress for a number of hit shows. And thanks to Auntie Vi, my mum and I, when I was a kid, attended some of these, sometimes not from the contained viewpoint of the stalls, but from the far more revealing perspective of the wings. And one show that sticks in my mind in particular was in one of the West End theatres when I was 10. And quite high up the bill was Vi's gentleman friend, Johnny, who was one of a trio of comedy tumblers. The trio's act, it was quite amazing to watch. The chaos world would suddenly attack these three, catapulting them all over the stage. It was hilarious, hilarious and dangerous. And you'll appreciate that central to the art of people like that is the ability to fall and to crash into things without injuring themselves. And that's a quality that I've bestowed on my fictional comedy acrobat. But for all the laughs that these three generated, they were very, very hard, determined, let's say, individuals. And an aspect of that was the language that they used when describing the trio's relationship with audiences. And this is where the Knock 'Em Dead title comes from. It's always struck me as interesting that actors in particular will refer to audiences in a very positive way. They'll say, oh, Imelda had the meeting out of the palm of her hat, or something like that. It's a positive exchange which comedians just don't share. From the comedian's point of view, the audience are a force to be overcome. They're the enemy, in effect. That accounts for the remarkably aggressive language that comedians use when describing their relationship with audiences. So going back to the wings of that London theatre, all those years ago, a stagehand said to Johnny in my hearing, "I was off last night, John, do you go down well? Did you and the lads? Go down well?" Johnny replied, "We killed him, mate. We slayed him. We knocked him dead." Well, Knock 'Em Dead's Amboise Pio is a far bigger star than Johnny ever dreamt of being, but behind his infinitely more successful comic mask, he too is a very determined man, as I hope readers of the book will enjoy discovering.
And it's set in Nice again. Are you discovering more about Nice? You must be using different areas of the city, finding getaway, different getaway routes, different haunts, that kind of thing, as you write.
Well, yes, I am. I mean, I know the area very well. And I must say, I do pull the odd fast one when it comes to this kind of thing, because some of the places that Darrick and co wind up policing actually is outside their jurisdiction. And I get around that by the fact that a lot of police cases in France are brought by a court official called the state prosecutor. And he will assign officers to whichever cases come up. And they have been known to send particularly successful groups of officers outside their region. And this particular story, most of it takes place in a village that doesn't actually exist. But I've called it La Crague du Var. And it's just a little way up the Var estuary, which more or less forms the western boundary of Nice. And I've made it up for the reason that there's a fair bit of corruption there, and I wanted to avoid being sued by anybody who thought, oh, this is our village.
And is the French system of policing very different to the British one? What kind of research have you had to do into that? You mentioned a slight difference there. Is it very different in other ways?
I think it is. I mean, most cases are brought by the state or public prosecutor. And if that's the case, people arrested and kept in custody were only allowed to see a lawyer for 30 minutes. The lawyer wouldn't be allowed to be there whilst interrogation happened. And also, that lawyer would not be allowed to see the dossier of the case. And so really, that meeting with the accused would only be to explain things on a kind of rough legal level. That system was very much open to abuse, as you can imagine. But one thing, you've got nobody there recording the interview. You've got no lawyer there most of the time. And as the number one method of securing convictions in France is confession, you can see that unscrupulous officers would use that to beat confessions out of people. But even now, a lawyer is allowed to be present during interrogations, but they're only allowed to ask questions at the end of the interview. They're not allowed to intervene. And that's one of the things that actually is discussed in this book. Talking to police officers is very helpful. But ultimately, you know, my goal is to write entertaining stories. So I take the odd liberty here and there.
And what's the reaction in Nice, do you know?
The books are not in translation. So the people that have come across them, it's slightly sort of few and far between, which is a real shame. I mean, I'd love that to be different. But the people that know Nice really like the books, I have to say, because it sort of brings it back to them. I did my best to describe the atmosphere of Nice and the landscape and the way things work there. But it's a very wonderful place. And so far, you know, people on the whole have been very kind about that, how I describe things there.
And there's obviously enough there for you to still feel interested to want to write about it and to still feel challenged by it, not just the place but the characters as well.
Yeah, very much so. I'm just writing the fifth book at the moment, and I've got the ideas for the next one after that. No, I'm very invested in it. And also, when you've developed a cast of characters, you know, you really want to see what they're going to do. It's odd that characters that I have created myself, but they seem to have a sort of an independent existence almost.
So have they gone in different directions than you anticipated?
One or two of them have this thing about characters talking to you. And this is really true. I mean, I almost never think now about when I have a dialogue sequence coming up. They are literally almost sort of standing behind me and speaking in my ear.
So do you know where they're going to go, their personal stories?
Well, I know where I would like them to go eventually. The thing that's obvious, I think, probably, and uppermost in a lot of people's minds when they think about Nice, is Bastille Day 2016. When there was the appalling atrocity on the Promenade des Anglais. There's a heck of a lot that could be written about that. And it would link very well back to my first book, In Pure Blood, which is about the question of cultural diversity.
And this is with Galileo Publishers, small press. Yeah, how have you found working with them?
Oh, marvellous. I mean, one of the things that happens when you're writing and you're either in broadcasting or in publishing is that the people with whom you've forged supportive relationships over the years, commissioning editors and producers and people like that, who've championed your novel or your script or whatever it may be and gone into meetings and battled for it, those people eventually move on. And that can leave you rather isolated and a bit adrift. And actually, it was that doyen of all booksellers and the patron saint of all crime writers, Richard Reynolds of Heffers, who felt that a perfect home for the Darrack mysteries would be Robert Hyde's Galileo publishing house. And Richard was, of course, quite right. Robert and I got on immediately. We were on the same page, literally. And I have to say that from submission of Knock 'Em Dead to the publication of it, the experience has been absolutely terrific. I'll give you an example of how well this works. I'd wanted for a while for the books to have an app-readable Spotify playlist in the end matter. Music is quite important in the books, although you don't need to be a jazz fan at all to enjoy the books. But nevertheless, there are references to numbers and artists. And I thought it would be a good idea if there were a playlist. And that's something that my previous publisher just wasn't interested in doing. But when I suggested that to Robert, he greeted that very enthusiastically. And indeed, we do have that.
Knock 'Em Dead by Peter Morfitt is published by Galileo. Our featured guest on Bookmark today has been Azadeh Moveni, talking about her book, Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of Isis, which is published by Scribe. Azadeh, what's next for you now then?
I would really love to work on something much lighter. I'm toying with the idea of a spy novel, because I have many plots of intrigue and fragments of characters in my mind from all of my years of reporting, and not least this last book. And I would love to pivot and turn that into a mashup, I don't know, Le Carré, Killing Eve, that can help me do something just a bit lighter and different for me with the same body of ghosts that follows me around.
Yeah, because as well as teaching journalism at NYU, you're a senior gender analyst at the International Crisis Group, which is a brilliant job, but I imagine not a laugh a minute.
It's not. It's more of the same. I mean, I work on women and conflict, so we essentially try to understand, and I work on places like Somalia and Nigeria and Iraq, and look at how conflicts impact women, how gender norms drive conflict and are exploited by actors and in conflict. So it's pretty heavy, but I enjoy it a great deal, I must say, because it sort of has taken me out of the Middle East, and I can look at these different dynamics in places I haven't worked on, Latin America, Colombia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and it's been really illuminating to sort of see dynamics that I was sort of imagined locked in a certain way are actually quite universal.
And one question that we ask all our guests here on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
I'm reading 5 Victorian Marriages. It's a book called Parallel Lives by Phyllis Rose. And I am enjoying it mightily. As the name suggests, it is a sort of biography of these 5 marriages: Thomas Carlyle, John Ruskin, George Eliot, John Stuart Mill. It's really a book about marriage, but also about Victorian writers and the politics of who has power in a marriage. And it's really deliciously written. It is not dry at all. It's 20 years old, but it still feels to me very contemporary. So I'm very pleased to be right in the middle of it.
Thank you, Azadeh. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. Just a heads up that on our next show, our featured guest is Christina Koning, talking about her crime novel, End of Term. We'll also hear from YA writer Anne-Marie Howell, talking about her novel, The House of 100 Clocks. And Jackie Ashley, former president of Lucy Cavendish College, Cambridge, and a member of the judging panel for the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize, talks about the recently announced long list. But we'll sign out now today with your last choice of music. This is the Habanera aria from Carmen. Why this?
2 reasons. I mean, I'm drawn to it because it reminds me of my mother, who I lost over a decade ago. And I grew up with her, just the 2 of us, and we went to the opera a lot. So some of my earliest memories are just sitting in the back of a dark opera concert hall and feeling surrounded by this heavy music that I could almost feel before I understood. And I remember Carmen in particular. It's partly a way that I feel close to my mother, listening to opera, but also because Carmen, I think, brings me also sort of close to the world that I work in, this idea of women and power and violence. And Carmen in particular reminds me of the ways that we talk about that kind of violence, and that it's very much, you know, in the very center of our experience in Western culture too, even though I think we sometimes apply different terms to it or pathologize it differently when it happens in cultures that are external to us. So Carmen sort of swirls all this together for me.